This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. What started as a Charlotte City Council passed ordinance banning discrimination by businesses in town against gay, lesbian, and transgender customers turned first into a statewide controversy once the legislature passed House Bill 2, which overturned the ordinance, then into a national issue once the Justice Department first ordered the state not to enforce the law and then filed suit to overturn it. And now has become an international issue with the European Union calling for the reconsideration of the law as soon as possible. But of course, we aren't a member of the European Union and are concerned only about our laws and how they intersect with the U.S. Constitution. And that is what is being tested with the dueling lawsuits filed first by Governor McCrory against the Department of Justice, the DOJ's suit against North Carolina, and the legislature's suit against the federal government. The governor has characterized the DOJ's demand that he promise not to enforce the law as federal overreach, and is asking the courts for clarification. U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch's lawsuit seeks a court order declaring House Bill 2's restroom restriction impermissibly discriminatory and requests the court bar its enforcement. She says the law is clear on the topic. So which way is this likely to go? What are the arguments on both sides and which is likely to win out? And what about the politics of all this in an election year? For answers to those questions and more, we turn to two legal experts and a political guru. Ted Shaw is the Julius L. Chambers Distinguished Professor of Law and Director of the Center for Civil Rights at the UNC School of Law. He joins us from the studios at WUNC in Durham. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Gregory Wallace is Associate Professor of Law at Campbell University School of Law, and he joins us by phone. Nice to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
And in our studio is Dr. Michael Bitzer, Provost and Professor of Political Science at Catawba College. Good to see you again as well.
Good to be here.
North Carolina's governor and the legislature seem to have been blindsided, at least initially, by the reaction to the passage of HB 2. Should they have been? I don't know who to ask that question of, whether it's a political question or it's a legal question. Start with the politics.
Well, I think it's both. And certainly what has surprised me over the past month and a half is both sides are basically talking past each other. You know, there's on the Republican side the issue of perceived safety concerns. There's been no documentation of transgender individuals going into bathrooms of the sex that they identify with and accosting people, having any kind of undue activity towards folks. But then you've got the perspective from the Democratic side about discrimination. And I think that's a real concern, that both sides are basically talking past each other and there's no real listening towards any kind of middle compromise. The legal aspects are also, you know, pretty much entrenched between a perspective of the federal government, how they define issues, and how the state has defined it as well.
So legally, should the legislature, should the governor have been surprised? Ted Shaw.
Well, I don't think that the legislature was surprised, that it would be surprised. I think anybody who had a political antenna or a legal antenna would know that there would be a challenge to this law. Look, the law was passed without any real debate. You know, it was passed without a lot of public consideration or really any public consideration, and that was done for a reason. I think that folks knew that there was going to be a reaction to this, and so that's the way it was done, the way it did. I also think in terms of the politics of this, as best as I can tell, I think that there are some folks for whom this is an issue that will turn some people out. At least I think some people hope that in the fall, particularly with this election year, when there's concern at the top of the Republican ticket that some people might otherwise stay home or go other places in terms of their vote.
Gregory Wallace, do you think that the legislature did this for political gain?
I don't think so. I think that HB 2 merely codifies the basic rules of bathroom, locker room, and shower access that have long existed in our society. If you have a male anatomy, use the male bathroom. If you have female anatomy, use the female bathroom. That's hardly a radical idea. And I don't think they were surprised, though, by the reaction. I think given last year's failed attempt to pass a religious freedom legislation and the opposition that was turned out against that by the LGBT community, I think the legislature was not taken off guard by this. One thing that's interesting, though, is that most people thought that after the Obergefell decision that recognized a constitutional right to same-sex marriage, the next step for the LGBT community would be to work on the legislative side of getting sexual orientation, gender identity included in federal non-discrimination laws first, and then on sort of a state-by-state basis with state non-discrimination laws. But instead, they seem to have taken a bit different tactic and moved toward this the transgender rights, which I think did catch some people by surprise.
This law does more than simply overturn Charlotte's ordinance mandating that businesses not discriminate against gay, lesbian, or transgender customers. It mandates separate bathrooms, as we've been talking about, and changing facilities for men based on the sex indicated by their birth certificate. It puts in place statewide wage and hour provisions, meaning that municipalities cannot set their own wage standards. It puts in place statewide employment practice and discrimination codes, which supersede any local codes and which do not include specific protections for gay, lesbian, or transgender individuals. And it ends the ability of people who believe they have been discriminated against in the workplace from suing in state court. With all that going on, why has the bathroom issue become the central focus of this?
Well, look, a couple of things. One is that on this last point, I think it's important to also keep in mind that the part of the law that cuts off the right to go to court for discrimination on any basis, whether we're talking about race, gender, religion. You can't go to state court in North Carolina anymore. You have to go through an administrative process, or your option is to go to federal court. And that's getting lost as this gets debated as a, quote, bathroom law or bathroom bill, end quote. It's much more than that. And also the shift away from local control, which historically has been something that conservatives have trumpeted again and again, and used against attempts to employ laws that are anti-discriminatory or have other bases. This is very ironic in many ways, because this is shifting away from the most local control to the state level, the decision or the ability to make decisions about wage and hours laws, as well as these issues that we've been talking about here. And finally, on this point, I don't think that the law as it was passed, as I said, was a surprise to anyone. But I also don't think that this is a manifestation of a strategic decision by a national LGBT community to decide that this is the next place we're going to go. Charlotte passed this law for its reasons, and then the state acted and it kind of blew up. I think in many respects this is an unlikely confrontation, but now that it's here, it's blown up, and it's not only likely, but it's real.
Well, the legislature started with the idea they were going to overturn Charlotte's ordinance, which included these bathroom provisions, but then they slipped all these other things into the bill. Why then did the Obama administration choose to focus on the bathroom portion of this when other things could probably have been attacked equally successfully?
Well, the Obama administration the federal court can't decide that the state of North Carolina has to force people to go into state court and provide that right of action. All it can do is maintain its federal right of action, nor can it do anything about the wage and hour laws. Well, I don't think it can anyway. Maybe I ought to think about that some more. But that is a state and local issue.
Okay, Gregory?
But the this is not the first time this whole dispute was not really the origins of the whole transgender bathroom dispute. I mean, you had this going on in other places, for example, in Virginia, in the lawsuit that led to the Fourth Circuit decision that came down just a few weeks ago. You had the Obama administration telling a school there early on that they had to under Title IX, that transgender students had a legal right to use the restroom of their choice. Now, with respect to the provisions in House Bill 2 that prohibit bringing state discrimination claims in state court, let me clarify something here, that you can still bring federal discrimination claims in state court. Federal law issues can be litigated in state court, or they can be litigated in federal court. Just depending on which one you choose, and the federal discrimination laws cover pretty much the same that the state discrimination laws under House Bill 2 cover, you know, race, religion, national origin, gender. So you can still bring discrimination claims in state court. They would simply have to be federal discrimination claims.
Why did this legislature do it then? Why did it take away the state
cause of action?
Well, I
don't agree with that part of the bill. And it's interesting in news reports, the legislators that were interviewed said they don't know how that part got into the bill. that's kind of you know, I don't believe that somebody had some reason, obviously, for putting it in there. But again, that's when you consider that there's still a right of action, the right to sue under federal law for discrimination. That sort of ameliorates the provisions here, even though I think they really should not have been put in the bill.
Dr. Bitzer, what's your take on this?
This is one of the classic controversies in American politics. Who has power? Which level of government? Is it the federal government? Is it the state government? Is it local government? This goes to the heart of our federalism system. And the notion and the ideas that governments can tell each other what they can and cannot do has been going on for centuries, as long as the American Republic has been founded. So this is, again, just continuing in my mind and my vision, playing at the heart of who and what we are and who has the final say. And oftentimes, guess what? It's money associated with it through Title IX, through Title VII. This is the classic controversy in American politics. Who's got power? Who can exercise it? And what can they do with it?
Okay. We have about...
But with all due respect, there's on this issue about this federal and state law basically doing the same thing. To go to federal court with an employment discrimination claim, one has to go first to the EEOC, which takes time. Otherwise, you lose your right of action. You have to get a right to sue letter. That's time. That's money. But the other thing that we have to keep in mind is that taking away this right of action in state court is a change in with respect to the articulation of what state values are when it comes to non-discrimination in employment.
We have a lot to cover here in the next 45 minutes or 40 minutes or whatever's left on this program. We're going to take a break and come back with more in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mecklenburg County Park and Recreation. Retro Vertigo brings music from the 80s back to life this Friday at First Ward Park, open to the public, uptowncharlotteparks.com. There is a trend in higher education, colleges and universities increasing reliance on adjunct faculty, non-tenured, part-time professors. They now make up more than 50% of faculties nationwide. Now, some adjuncts say they are being exploited, and what used to be a prestigious profession has become a part-time gig with no benefits and low pay. So we're going to look into what's happening and how how it's affecting higher education, and those at the head of the class on this program tomorrow morning at 9. We're coming right back.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Obama administration tells public schools across the country to let transgender students use the bathroom of their choice. Debate over transgender rights and the legal, social, and financial implications.
Join the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the legal and political ramifications of HB 2 and the lawsuits that are flying back and forth between the state and federal governments on this issue. Theodore Shaw is with us. He's the Julius Chambers Distinguished Professor of Law and the Director of the Center for Civil Rights at the UNC School of Law. Gregory Wallace is an Associate Professor of Law at the Campbell University School of Law. And Dr. Michael Bitzer is Provost of and Political Science Professor at Catawba College. Professor Wallace, Attorney General Lynch seems fairly certain that she has legal standing in this issue, and the government is said to have a solid track record of success in civil rights lawsuits similar to the one they filed against North Carolina. But you say that the Justice Department's case is paper thin. How so?
The Justice Department and the Department of Education's interpretation of Title IX, the Justice Department's interpretation of Title VII, don't take into consideration the conflicting privacy interests that occur when a biological male enters a female locker room or shower, or vice versa. Because Johnny thinks he's a girl, he wants the legal right to use the same locker room at a school that Mary and Susie and other girls use, where he would see them take off their clothes and use the shower, and where he would walk around in front of them without any clothes on. Now, when you give transgender persons the legal right to use whatever restroom, locker room, or other changing facility they choose, non-transgendered persons are going to be required to disrobe, shower, and perform personal bodily functions in the presence of those with intimate body parts different from their own, and to observe private parts that are different than their own. I mean, when you think about it, why do we have separate bathrooms and locker rooms in the first place? It's because we have different bodies, not different gender identities. We want to protect the privacy and safety interests that arise from our physical differences. And while transgender persons have privacy rights, so do non-transgender persons. Neither the Department of Justice's position, their letters that to the governor and to the University of North Carolina system, nor actually the recent Fourth Circuit decision addressed situations where there are competing privacy claims. In fact, in that Fourth Circuit case, the lawsuit was about bathrooms only. The student there did not seek admission to locker rooms, and the school had modified its bathrooms to ensure no exposure of private parts. So when you look at this policy in light of conflicting privacy issues, the weight of judicial authority is on the side of protecting the privacy interests.
What about that, Theodore Shaw? How do you balance privacy versus civil rights?
Well, privacy is an important consideration, although if we think through all of this, first, as we just heard, there was an adjustment made in Virginia with respect to showers. It was all about bathrooms. Bathrooms tend to be places where the most private of activities take place. In women's bathrooms, my understanding and what I know is that most of them have private stalls. In men's bathroom, bathrooms are not as private. But the concern that I think probably would arise in men's bathrooms with a transgendered person, if that person were called out somehow as transgendered, would be of the safety of that transgender person. in that bathroom. That would be the concern that I would see with respect to showers and locker rooms. I think probably many transgender people are more concerned than anyone else about taking a shower and exposing the fact that they have male, for example, genitalia. I don't know that that's been a big issue anywhere, and I think what we hear is a lot of concerns that have not been factually substantiated here. This is a culture war more than anything else, I think. All of the concerns about women and children being exposed to dangers, you know, I haven't seen a whole lot of substantiation about that really being a factor. It's a lot of political rhetoric.
Gregory Wallace, you have written, and you just kind of said this a moment ago, that HB2 does not discriminate against LGBT people any more than it does against other special classes, and instead offers a reasonable balancing of conflicting privacy interests. But this law does put in place statewide codes that don't specifically mention LGBT people, replacing local codes in some places that have specifically mentioned them. So how does this not discriminate?
Well, it certainly doesn't single out, as the Colorado amendment did in the Romer case, homosexuals, lesbians, and bisexuals, and prohibits specifically protections for those. It doesn't target a specific group or class. It simply protects some classes but not others. In fact, the public accommodations provision of House Bill 2 looks very much like the public accommodations law under the Civil Rights Act of 1964, except that it actually adds a protected class there of biological sex. And while it doesn't include sexual orientation or gender identity, it doesn't include age, disability, or economic class, or pregnancy, or marital status, or veteran status, or other protected classes that you find in some discrimination laws. It targets at most by omission, and it doesn't, even then, it doesn't target a single specific group. There are several groups that are omitted. In fact, I think it's over 30 states right now in their public accommodation laws do not include sexual orientation or gender identity. So with respect to the public accommodations law that's part of House Bill 2, this stands pretty much in the mainstream of what both the federal government and state governments have done.
So that's why, in your opinion, under the Civil Rights Act, this is not unconstitutional, because even though it protects some classes but not other classes of people.
Well, I think it's not – if you're going to make the argument that omitting sexual orientation and gender identity is somehow – makes the law unconstitutional, then I think you've got to explain why the Constitution requires that sexual orientation and gender identity be included in a non-discrimination law. And then, if that's the case, then what other categories? And I've not really seen any sort of explanation along those lines.
Ted Shaw, you worked in the civil rights movement for a very, very long time, and you said that you've come to understand that discrimination against LGBT people is wrong. To use your words, you believe that it's been clear for some time that discrimination on the basis of who and what people are goes against our most basic fundamental laws. And you cite a familiar pattern in the actions of right-wing conservatives in which facts don't get in the way. But is that part of the argument here? The court won't be considering any of that, will they?
Well, yeah, I said all that. I meant all that, and I'd say it again. But I want to just point out that there is some old case law under the Constitution, under the 14th Amendment in particular. There's a case coming from the 1880s, Yickwo versus Hopkins, that talks about the ability to find a violation of the 14th Amendment where the law in question impacts on a particular group. And where it's clear that that was what was intended, even though the legislators who enacted the law didn't say that. Everybody knows what this law is about. So we can dance around what it says specifically and what it doesn't say. You know, in the case of Yik Wo versus Hopkins, it was about laundry operators in San Francisco, the overwhelming majority of whom were Chinese. You know, the white Chinese operators didn't have to abide by this code, or they weren't arrested or fined like the Chinese operators were. So that's old established case law. It had to do with race. But if we look at the parallel here, everybody knows what this law is about and who's going to be affected. So, you know, we can dance around about this, but I think it's pretty clear that this is discriminatory in intent. And even if we doubt that, you have one of the legislators who was behind the law saying in a public statement, we want to keep North Carolina straight.
Hmm. Politically, did this start as simply a Republican legislature going after a city democratically controlled – a democratically controlled city and something they tried to do? Is that how it started, or was there more to it than that, Dr. Bitz?
I think it started certainly that way. There was very clear enunciation from the city of Charlotte. In fact, they looked at this ordinance and the bathroom provision a year ago, defeated it then. We then had a mayoral election. The Democratic candidate, Jennifer Roberts, ran on this platform, was very clear that she was going to be seeking this reintroduction of this ordinance, and it went through and passed. And again, you know, the governor got involved and said, don't pass it. And then when there were calls for the special session, he said, no, I'm not going to do it. So the legislature called themselves into session. You know, there is politics going on, but it represents, I think, the dichotomy in North Carolina of we can look at the same issue and have differing public opinions about it. Let me give you an example. In a poll taken for Time Warner Cable News, should transgender people be allowed to use the bathroom of the gender they identify with? 51% of North Carolinians said they should not. You ask the next question, should lesbian, gay, and bisexual and transgender individuals be specifically included in any law preventing discrimination along with race, religion, color, national origin, or biological sex? 53% of North Carolinians said yes. So, you know, it is this issue that encapsulates this bipolar political perspective in the state. And everybody seems to be thinking, I'm right on this and everybody else is wrong.
When this happened, a lot of people questioned why Jennifer Roberts decided to push this issue. It had already been defeated once by the city council, and she came in and pushed it through successfully at very early in her tenure as mayor. And some people have speculated that it was because of the Obama administration, that the Obama administration saw this happen in Charlotte, saw it had elected another Democratic mayor. Mm-hmm. Perhaps she would help push this through and make this an issue that they could, knowing that the Republican legislature would probably react against this, they could make this part of their last hurrah.
Their legacy, the Obama legacy.
Anything to that, do you think?
People are going to think about conspiracies all the time, and I can't dissuade them facts otherwise, but we don't know.
Both the governor and the legislature want clarification of the law by the courts because they say the Obama administration is trying to make laws through actions like their approach to HB 2 and the order they issued last week mandating that public schools allow transgender students to use bathrooms of the gender with which they identify as long as the parents of those students certify the truth of that transition in some sort of statement. Do they have a point, or is this something that every administration does in the course of trying to execute the laws passed by Congress?
Well, this is part of bureaucratic discretion. I mean, once the legislature writes a law, it is oftentimes left up to the bureaucracy to figure out what do those words mean, and in particularly, what does sex mean? I mean, does it include things like gender expression and gender identity? And I think that's where the big conflict oftentimes comes about, and we seek to the courts to say, yes, this is within the discretionary power of a federal bureaucracy to include that as a reasonable interpretation of the words or not.
Theodore Shaw, Attorney General Lynch seemed confident the law and the court decisions were on her side, and you have pointed out that in recent years the Supreme Court, with five conservative judges on the bench, has ruled against discriminatory laws and practices on the basis of sexual orientation. You believe that sets precedent here?
Well, there's this case up in Virginia that was in the Fourth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals that's very similar to the issues or raises the issues that were raised here. That shouldn't be a surprise because, as we have seen in recent years, either because of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, or, you know, Chamber of Commerce or other groups, we see cookie-cutter legislation being replicated state after state. And so that's how these things begin to come up. It isn't necessarily that the federal government has been pushing to make these the national laws that everybody has to follow. Yes, I do think that we have a scenario where the U.S. Department of Education had already drafted guidelines on this issue, and so they've now come into play here under Title IX, and there's a concern about Title VII. One other thing that I want to say, this for me, and I suspect for most North Carolinians and people in general, this has not been an issue that has been intuitive. You know, this is not an issue that people came to – most people come to understand, and it's still an issue that many people are growing to understand. But I see – children interviewed on in the media who at the age of 5 years old or younger say that I'm a girl, even though they were born with male genitalia. I don't think they're making this stuff up, and we can try to force them to be what they're not. But I think that it's deepened at least my understanding of all of the nuances and complexities of gender identity, and I think more people are coming to understand that these things are much more complicated than what we once thought they were. And I think the answer isn't to subordinate people, shame them, discriminate against them. I think the answer is to work together to find some kind of understanding where we do respect people's privacy, but we also don't discriminate against people and shame them because of who and what they are.
Understanding does shift through time. There are societal adjustments, and that's, I guess, how the court system works too. Would you say that's true, Gregory Wallace? And might this be one of those – are we in the middle of one of those shifts right now?
Well, certainly you could look at the gay marriage issue and say, yes, that's what happened there. You know, not everybody agrees with the fact that courts ought to be changing the law based on societal shifting societal values. There are good arguments that really is outside the scope of what courts should be doing. I want to make a reference to the polling that Dr. Bitzer mentioned a moment ago. I think it's possible for people to believe that transgender persons should not have a legal right to use whatever bathroom they choose, and also believe consistently that transgender persons should not be discriminated against otherwise, you know, in the workplace. I mean, a person shouldn't be fired simply for being transgender. It's interesting because...
Well, let me stop you there, Gregory. We can come back after the break and you can finish that thought, but we have to take this break now. And when we come back, we'll also share with you some of the things that have been coming in from listeners. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Treliant Federal Credit Union, a member-owned, not-for-profit community credit union, 12 Charlotte area locations, including Ballantyne, Steel Creek, and Park Road. Treliant, life improved. Details at Treliant.org. Well, the conversation about HB2 continues on the Diane Rehm Show, but with a focus on what it means for public schools across the country. The Obama administration, of course, last week told public schools across the country to allow transgender students to use bathrooms of their choice. That has created even more debate, and they'll talk about that in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. We're going to be hosting a series of voter roundtables on Charlotte Talks next week with listeners on the panel, and we're still looking for a couple of conservative-leaning voters to join us. Find out more about this and get in touch with our producers right now at WFAE.org. Want to join our conversation? You can email us at charlottetalks@WFAE.org or reach us through Facebook or Twitter, and we are coming right back.
Mike McNamara of Greer Walker in Charlotte, a WFAE underwriter.
We still get people who say, oh, I heard you on WFAE. You guys are bigger than I thought you were. We're part of the community. WFAE is part of the community, so it makes total sense to us that we would be part of the WFAE family. WFAE makes it easy. It's effective. We can't think of anything we'd rather do.
For more information, email underwriting at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. In our studio, Dr. Michael Bitzer from Catawba College, lending us a political point of view on the HB2 discussion. And then we have two legal eagles with us today. Ted Shaw, who's the Julius L. Chambers Distinguished Professor of Law and the Director of the Center for Civil Rights at the UNC School of Law. He joins us from WUNC in Durham. And Gregory Wallace, Associate Professor of Law at the Campbell University School of Law, joins us by phone. And I had to stop you in the middle of a point you were making about how we can have varying opinions in polls in North Carolina about whether or not LGBT people should be discriminated against. The polls say no, versus them using the bathrooms that do not identify with the gender on their birth certificate, to which voters say no. So go ahead and finish your point, Dr.
A very prominent law professor in 1975 wrote an editorial that tried to dispel fears that a proposed federal law might lead to men using female restrooms. And what she did was she drew a distinction between areas such as restrooms and changing facilities where privacy should be protected, and areas such as the workroom where equality should be protected. And that prominent law professor was now Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And I think she has a point there, that there are places where privacy should trump equality.
But do we have a constitutional right to privacy? We've talked about this with regard to the eavesdropping, the wiretapping, etc. In the federal government, we keep hearing that we don't have a right to privacy, and it's not written into the Constitution.
Well, it depends on how you define. I mean, how specific or how you define the right to privacy. The Constitution protects privacy interests in a number of ways. For example, the Fourth Amendment mm-hmm. protects privacy in your home and in your stuff from unreasonable searches and seizures by the government. But to answer your question, yes, several lower courts have held that there is a constitutional right to privacy that covers the right not to be seen while you are in a state of undress, and that, I think, is one question that you know has to be addressed here. Even if you don't have a constitutional right to privacy, there are still obvious privacy interests that exist. When you have people with different genitalia dressing and taking showers together.
Let me share with you some of the comments that have been coming in as we've been talking on email and Facebook and Twitter. Russell emails, when can an ordinance or law supersede an existing law? If there are two conflicting laws, what is the course of action to resolve this conflict? I guess it would be the court system, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Well, I think it would, but I think there are certain rules that the courts are going to apply. This is not just a sort of an open-ended decision. In North Carolina, we are what's called a Dillon's Rule state, where the local governments get their legal power and authority from the state legislature. And so the state legislature can pass laws that trump local government laws. That's the way it is in North Carolina. As far as federal and state laws go, in Article 6 of the Constitution, we have the Supremacy Clause, which says that when a federal law conflicts with a state law, the federal law wins. Federal law trumps conflicting state law.
Roger in China Grove, it's a shame that instead of wasting all the energy blaming each other for the bathroom bill, that we can't all get together and attack the real problem, how to enhance or provide safe, secure, and private bathroom facilities for everyone. Surely we can work together to solve this problem rather than retreat to our corners and shout at each other. Francis writes, the worst parts of HB2 are the overreach of the governor and legislature into our county government systems. In this case, it would actually be the city government. Sure, the county commissioners, in this case, it would be the city council, may not get things right, but at least they are not dictating to all other counties or cities in this case. In the state, this part of the law has not been emphasized enough. But as you just said, Gregory Wallace, cities operate under the permission of the legislature. Karen on Facebook thinks HB 2 will be overturned in court. Pat McCrory will brag about how he stood up to the Department of Justice and blame the overturning of this bill on Obama. He will take no responsibility for this debacle and waste time. A waste of time and money. Tell what's your take on that, Dr. Bitz?
I think certainly some of the more recent polls that we've seen, Pat McCrory's numbers have taken a slight hit. This is going to be one of the most competitive gubernatorial elections in the country, and it looks like he has taken a hit because of the fierceness of his defense of this, but we'll just have to wait and see. I mean, it seems like this issue has been going on now for a month and a half. It will be part of the fall campaign, whether it is the indeed sole driver of people's voting, who knows?
It is conservatives and Republicans who are in most of favor, who are most in favor of HB 2, but the apparent GOP nominee, Donald Trump, is not in favor of the law. How might that play out? How might it affect the down ballot in North Carolina specifically?
Well, it was interesting that he came out with that, but also remember this is a candidate who can change his mind within the same interview
subject. And in fact, he has said from this point forth, everything he says is just a suggestion.
Exactly. So, you know, we're dealing with that as well. What is fascinating to me also is the age difference that is going on. Much like with same-sex marriage, this issue has taken on a generational cohort change. Younger voters have no problem.
Except apparently. Donald Trump is not a younger voter.
Right.
And
right.
He has said that he has no problem with the transgendered individuals working in his company or...
He has said that. The question I think needs to be asked, do you have a problem with them being in the bathrooms? And like Gregory has said and like others have said, you know, the issue of workplace versus restroom facilities, therein lies the crux.
So if the governor has taken a hit because of HB 2, and I think you just said that, how will it impact Roy Cooper, who is the attorney general, a Democrat running against Pat McCrory? And yet he has, as the attorney general said, he will not defend any suits that arise as a result of HB 2.
I think both of them are playing to their respective party bases. I mean, Roy Cooper is playing to the base that is located in predominantly urban, much more Democratic areas. Pat McCrory is playing to a base that is much more rural in nature, social conservative. And so I think both of them could have been seen as kind of moderates in this perspective, but they've been forced to their respective corners because of their party bases here in North Carolina.
Marilyn in Valdez writes, I thought a transgender person was someone who was receiving medical treatment to change their gender. They take hormones and many have had surgery to change their private parts. If these medical treatments are allowed by law, why would we make it illegal for them to go to the bathroom of the sex to which they have been changed? Isn't the problem here, I'm talking to the two professors of law here, the problem here is that many transgender people have not been through the surgery and choose not ever to go through the surgery, but they identify, as we have said, as women or men in the opposite of what their birth certificate would say. So in that case, even how do you enforce it? If you look like a woman because you've chosen to take the hormones at least, or you look like a man for the same reason, and you dress that way, how are we to know whether or not you've had the surgery? Are we going to have some sort of an X-ray machine or an inspector at the door?
Well, I think the questions that you ask are very good questions, and I think the answer is that in many instances, maybe in most instances, we won't know without some, I think, unthinkable intrusion on people's privacy, if we want to talk about privacy. And so I think that's exactly right. And there's a lot to be said for those who say that the law, HB 2, is not enforceable. But it does give a political battle to those who passed it. One other thing on this is that this should have been debated. Maybe some of these nuances could have been worked out, or there could have been parts of the bill that would have worked differently or more thoughtfully, but there was no real debate. And I think that that was a blow against the way our democracy should work.
Money talks. So let's talk about Title IX and Title VII. Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 prohibits discrimination in the workplace based on sex, race, color, national origin, or religion. Title IX prohibits exclusion from participation in any educational program receiving federal funds on the basis of sex. So how do either or both of these come into play in the cases created by these three lawsuits at the state and federal level?
Well, I think that the cases are going to come down to pretty much a single question, and that is, what does sex discrimination mean under both Title VII and Title IX? Title VII, as you said, applies to employment. Title IX applies to education, and courts generally have interpreted the meaning of sex discrimination in those two separate laws as being one and the same. I mean, whatever sex discrimination under Title VII is going to be sex discrimination under Title IX. So I think the question is going to be, what does sex discrimination mean, and whether it means gender identity or whether it means biological sex, or in some cases, whether it means both. Now, the Obama administration has taken the position that it means gender identity, or at least it includes gender identity, but there are some problems with that bad interpretation. As I said earlier, I don't think it takes into account conflicting privacy interests. There is a whole line of recent cases, actually, from the Ninth Circuit, the Tenth Circuit, the Sixth Circuit, and a couple of district courts that have specifically addressed cases involving transgender persons in restrooms, and they have all come out on the side of privacy interests, with the exception of the Fourth Circuit case. So I think the Obama administration's interpretation of that is going to be contested, I think, vigorously in these court cases.
Would you agree with that, Ted Shaw?
Well, I agree with most of it, we could talk about those other cases. I think there's some nuances in some of them. But we are in the Fourth Circuit. That's the most significant thing here. And at least under the Fourth Circuit's decision in the Virginia case, which arguably will be controlling here, you know, absent some kind of further review by either the full Fourth Circuit, which hasn't happened, or the U.S. Supreme Court, which is potentially deadlocked right now. Mm-hmm. Talk about another issue that
4-4.
You know, should be on our mind. That's right. That's assuming that Justice Kennedy would continue to move in the direction he moved into in the same-sex marriage cases. But absent all of that, the Fourth Circuit has already spoken on this issue.
Professor,
well, I don't think it has spoken on the issue because, as I said, the case involved bathrooms only, not showers and locker rooms, and the school had made modifications where there were no exposure of private genitalia in bathrooms. And as we talked about earlier, you know, how do we know? Well, I don't think in bathrooms we're going to know, but we're going to know whether a person has had sex reassignment surgery, certainly in showers and in locker rooms.
Go ahead.
Fair enough, but when I said on this issue, the question of whether or not the gender identity that the federal government has spoken to under Title IX prohibits discrimination on that basis, and that the Fourth Circuit has spoken to, the nuances of the North Carolina law as compared to the Virginia law can be argued, and you're right about that. But as I said, that could have been addressed if there had really been a debate on this issue here in North Carolina. There hasn't been.
We only have a couple minutes left, so I want to get some quick answers on this. Some believe that North Carolina's action is based on hate. I know that Gregory Wallace, you say there's no animus here whatsoever. Others say it's based on common sense privacy issues. You would agree with that. So does motivation make any difference to the court?
Well, certainly it does if you're dealing with this on a constitutional level, which is that's an issue that's involved in the lawsuit that initially was brought against House Bill 2 by the private parties. It really doesn't play into the lawsuits involving the state and the federal governments here, because those concern interpretation of federal statutes, Title IX and Title VII. So, if this was motivated by some unconstitutional animus, there is a case law that would suggest then it would be struck down as unconstitutional. But
how
there
do you
are
prove
not constitutional
that?
Issues involved in the lawsuits between the state and the federal government.
How do you prove that? How do you prove animus?
That's the $64,000 question, and I think Justice Kennedy in the Romer case suggests that when a particular group is simply targeted for disfavorable treatment, as it was in that case, where they had a constitutional amendment that that specifically prohibited any sort of non-discrimination laws protecting lesbian, gay, or homosexuals in that case. That's not what you have here in North Carolina, so I think it would be more difficult to prove animus here than it was in the leading case on constitutional animus.
Now, well, respectfully, I disagree. There's a well-established case law that comes out of race discrimination cases about how animus is proven. Just look to the case law there, our Arlington Heights, Washington versus Davis. But also the legislatures here haven't helped themselves. Some of them have been very open about what they're doing and why.
So is this going to be something, Dr. Bitzer, that we revisit every election cycle, or something that eventually fades into the mists of history?
I think it'll be determinative this election cycle. It'll probably fade into history at some point.
Dr. Michael Bitzer is provost of and professor of political science at Catawba College. And thanks to Theodore Shaw, Julius L. Chambers, distinguished professor of law and the director of the Center for Civil Rights at the UNC School of Law, and Gregory Wallace, associate professor of law at the Campbell University School of Law. Thank you all for the hour.